consider the following. From July 8, 1972 through July 22, 1972, Jane Fonda made her famous visit to Hanoi, where she delivered radio broadcasts to American and South Vietnamese military personnel encouraging mutiny and desertion, while repeatedly claiming that the United States was responsible for war crimes and atrocities. Fonda visited American prisoners of war in Hanoi, reporting in broadcasts from Hanoi that the American prisoners were being well cared for and that they wished to convey their sense of disgust of the war and their shame for what they have been asked to do. A photograph was taken of Fonda sitting in a North Vietnamese anti-aircraft gun, wearing a Vietnamese helmet, surrounded by North Vietnamese military. Upon leaving North Vietnam, Fonda accepted from her hosts a ring made from the wreckage of a downed American plane. From July 29, 1972 through August 12, 1972, former Attorney General Ramsey Clark traveled to Hanoi on behalf of the Stockholm International Commission for Inquiry. Clark denounced the United States bombing of Vietnam and visited American prisoners of war, reporting that their health was good and the conditions of their imprisonment could not be better. In the summer of 1972, both the Democratic and the Republican parties decided to hold their national conventions in Miami Beach, Florida. The VVAW organized a protest called The Last Patrol, urging VVAW members to travel to the protest campsite set up in Flamingo Park. On the last night of the Republican National Convention, when President Nixon gave his renomination acceptance speech, a riot broke out in the streets of Miami Beach, and over 900 demonstrators were arrested. In his campaign for congressional office in Lowell, Massachusetts, John Kerry's early efforts were quite successful. Through winning the Democratic primary for that office in October 1972, Kerry continued to emphasize his anti-war activities and his association with the VVAW. When UPI announced John Kerry's primary victory, he was still being described as a spokesman for the VVAW. In another race where the Vietnam War was a pivotal issue, John Kerry, spokesman for Vietnam Veterans Against the War, won the Democratic nomination for Congress in Lowell, Massachusetts. Tom Teed, a reporter who followed Kerry's campaign in Massachusetts, wrote a UPI article right after Kerry's primary win, when he was strongly ahead in the polls, clearly identifying his association with the VVAW. Kerry, you'll recall, is the thrice-wounded Vietnam naval veteran, his boat took 188 enemy hits, who brought GIs to the front lines of the anti-war battle in 1969. He didn't invent the organization known as Vietnam Veterans Against the War, but he became its most eloquent spokesman. "I knew the first day I got there it was wrong, and I was ashamed to be part of it. The Kid Corps of America embraced him. So did the national media. He became a new kind of war hero, a man who won a Silver Star for bravery and then gave it back to the government out of resentment for its occasion." The record shows that up until the time he lost the 1972 congressional contest, Kerry continued to present himself as an anti-war activist. Yet, when campaigning for president in 2004, Kerry tried to advance the argument that he had resigned from the VVAW in November 1971. The only reason to advance this lie was to hope that he could disavow VVAW radical activities occurring during the time Kerry associated his name with theirs. What John Kerry does not want you to know about his naval reserve status. Early in the 2004 campaign, Kerry presented his Navy service record with a convenient gap. The year 1971 was presented as if John Kerry had no military obligation at this time. The year was important because 1971 was the time of many important VVAW protest activities. Early in 2004, the following language describing Kerry's military service appeared on Kerry's campaign website, www.johnkerry.com. By June 2004, this paragraph had been removed. John Kerry is a decorated combat veteran of the Vietnam War. Kerry volunteered for the United States Navy after college and served from 1966 through 1970, rising to the rank of lieutenant junior grade. Afterwards, Kerry continued his military service in the United States Naval Reserves from 1972 through 1978. The year 1971 is left out of the description. This omission was deceptive. In response to a request by Senator Kerry, the Department of the Navy released a letter detailing the missing period. In a letter dated May 24, 1986, the Navy listed the following. 18 February 1966. Enlisted as an OCSA E2 U.S. Naval Reserve inactive. 19 August 1966. Commenced active duty as an OCIU-2, E-5. 15 December 1966. Honorably discharged as an OCIU-2 to accept commission in United States Naval Reserve. 16 December 1966. Accepted commission, Ensign, United States Naval Reserve. Continued active duty. 16 June 1968. Date of rank as Lieutenant Junior Grade, O2, United States Naval Reserve. 1 January 1970. Date of rank as Lieutenant, O3, United States Naval Reserve. 3 January 1970. Released from active duty, transferred to the Naval Reserve, inactive. 1 July 1972. Transferred to the Standby Reserve, inactive. 16 February 1978, honorably discharged from the United States Naval Reserve as a Lieutenant, O3. This record makes it clear that John Kerry was always in the Naval Reserves while he served in the military. He enlisted in the Naval Reserves and was initially inactive. He commenced his active duty in August 1966 and was commissioned as an ensign again in the U.S. Naval Reserves in December 1966. John Kerry enlisted in the U.S. Naval Reserves, and he never left the U.S. Naval Reserves. The letter dated January 2, 1970, releasing John Kerry from active duty and transferring him to inactive duty in the Naval Reserve, stated in paragraph 6, "You are advised that your release from active duty does not terminate your status as a member of the U.S. Naval Reserve. On the day following the effective date of your release from active duty, as specified in paragraph 3 of this endorsement, you will assume the status of a member of the Naval Reserve on inactive duty. While on inactive duty, you are subject to involuntary recall to active duty to the extent authorized by federal statute." There is an important distinction between being in the Naval Reserves on inactive duty and being in the Standby Reserves on inactive duty. Standby reserve status would permit a person to argue that he was a civilian for all intents and purposes. A person in the Naval Reserves is still considered in the Navy. Inactive duty means that the individual or the unit to which that individual has been assigned has not been called up for active duty. Again, note the similarity. John Kerry, when he entered the Navy on February 18, 1966, entered the Naval Reserves on inactive duty. He did not commence active duty until August 19, 1966. As a member of the Naval Reserves, Kerry would have held a Naval Reserve identification card. He would have received Navy pay, and he would have had continuing, though minimal, obligations to report to official Navy requests for training, and to respond to any Navy inquiries advanced to him. In 1971, John Kerry was still in the Navy, even though his status was Naval Reserves inactive duty. To put Kerry's anti-war activities in context, we must remember that he was a member of the Naval Reserves until July 1972, when he was placed on standby Naval Reserve. Kerry's anti-war activities included meeting with the enemy in Paris and coordinating ongoing meetings with various members of the VVAW, both in Paris and Hanoi, to arrange the release of American prisoners of war to the VVAW. These meetings also provided aid and support to the North Vietnamese communists in the form of radio broadcasts and other indoctrination methods aimed at encouraging U.S. soldiers in the field to lay down their arms and desert the military. Testifying before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that the United States was implementing a military policy in Vietnam that caused American soldiers to commit war crimes and atrocities, and that this criminal military policy extended up the entire chain of command. Giving a press conference in Washington, D.C., in which he advocated a Vietnamese communist peace proposal that would have called for a complete withdrawal of the United States military and an abandonment of the government of South Vietnam. In other words, a surrender on enemy terms, followed by the payment of war damage reparations by the United States to the Vietnamese communists. Continuing his representation of the VVAW even after he was aware that various VVAW leaders had falsified their credentials and were not, in fact, Vietnam veterans. Telling many slanderous and otherwise damaging lies in numerous public speeches, the effect of which was to malign the purpose and morality of the United States service personnel in the field in Vietnam, fighting and dying as he spoke. Allowing his speeches and testimony to be used by the enemy in their propaganda efforts, including, but not limited to, the replaying of these speeches and testimony to American prisoners of war being held in captivity by our enemies. What is clear from the record is that Kerry lied or otherwise misrepresented his continued service in the Naval Reserves so as to give the impression that he was not affiliated in any way with the U.S. military when he engaged in his radical protest activities. The truth is that Kerry was still in the military when he protested against his own brothers in arms. This raises the additional concern that Kerry's anti-war activities may well have been in direct violation of the obligations of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which prohibit him from making adverse charges against his chain of command or statements against his country, especially in time of war. Chapter 9. Kerry's Communist Honors. I deeply resent John Kerry's using his Swift Boat experience and his betrayal of those who fought there as a stepping stone to his political ambitions. Bernard Wolfe, Swift Boat Veterans for Truth Press Conference, Washington, D.C., May 4, 2004. The Find, War Remnants Museum, Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam. In the Vietnamese Communist War Remnants Museum, formerly known as the War Crimes Museum in Ho Chi Minh City, a photograph of John Kerry hangs in a room titled, "The World Supports Vietnam in Its Resistance." The photograph shows Senator John Kerry being greeted by the General Secretary of the Communist Party of Vietnam, Comrade Do Muoi. The story broke over the 2004 Memorial Day weekend. Jeffrey M. Epstein of Vietnam Vets for the Truth acquired the photograph in response to a request for photographs and records detailing Kerry's activities on behalf of the enemy. Epstein explained the importance of the photograph upon releasing it to the public. "This photograph's unquestionable significance lies in its placement in the American Protesters section of the War Crimes Museum in Saigon. The Vietnamese communists clearly recognize John Kerry's contributions to their victory. This find can be compared to the discovery of a painting of Neville Chamberlain hanging in a place of honor in Hitler's Eagle's Nest in 1945. Vietnam veteran Bill Lupetti happened upon the Carey photo when touring the War Remnants Museum in Ho Chi Minh City. Lupetti, who had served as a Navy corpsman working with swiftboat sailors in An Toi, was back in Vietnam for the first time since the war, trying to find old friends and visit familiar locations. He took a picture of the Carey photograph and posted it and a dozen other photographs on an internet website maintained by swiftboat veteran Jim Deal. A third swiftboat veteran, Bob Shirley, copied the photograph from the website and emailed it to Jeff Epstein. The research began from there. The War Remnants Museum was established in 1975. Then called the War Crimes Museum, its principal purpose was to demonstrate what the Vietnamese communists wanted to represent as American war crimes, including graphic displays of war injuries. Outside the museum is a collection of captured U.S. tanks, airplanes, and helicopters, as well as bombs and other unexploded munitions. Some of the exhibits are gruesome. In particular, one featuring deformed babies that purports to document the effects of Agent Orange laced with thalidomide, a charge advanced by the communists during and after the war. Even today, the museum makes no attempt at balance, even though the name change makes it appear less confrontational and many of the exhibits are pure propaganda. Lupetti found the Carey photograph in a hall dedicated to honoring war heroes who had helped the Vietnamese communists win in their military struggle against the United States, and later against the Chinese. By posting Carey's photograph in this hall, the Vietnamese communists acknowledge what they view as his supporting contribution. Across the hall from the Carey photograph is a photograph of early war protester David Miller, shown burning his draft call-up notice in 1965. The room is filled with banners and anti-war posters from groups around the world whose anti-war demonstrations had helped advance the communist cause during the Vietnam War. On the Monday of Memorial Day weekend, May 31, 2004, www.wintersoldier.com published the Carey photo on the Internet. The Carey presidential campaign, as anticipated, declined to comment and quietly questioned whether the photograph had been doctored. Unofficial word from campaign officials suggested that the photograph did not actually appear in the museum. Carey supporters argued that the photograph really did not demonstrate that the Vietnamese communists were honoring Carey for his anti-war protest activity. They contended that the photograph documented Carey's work for the Clinton administration in seeking to normalize relations with Vietnamese communists after the war. We contacted Bill Lupetti in Ho Chi Minh City and asked him to return to the museum to take additional photographs to document that the Carey picture was indeed there. We talked with him about the museum and the Carey photograph. Question: Bill, is the Carey photograph still there? Bill Lupetti: Yes, it sure is. I've been back to the museum 4 times now, and the Carey photograph is definitely there. Question: Does the photograph honor him for his anti-war protests or for the work he did with Vietnam during the Clinton administration? Bill Lupetti: Carey's photo is in a hall of the museum that is called The World Supports Vietnam in Its Resistance. The whole museum is dedicated to the war. There are U.S. tanks and airplanes outside. That particular hall has photos of war protesters like David Miller. There are posters and banners from anti-war groups around the world who supported the Vietnamese communists in the war. The communists are saying that everybody in that hall helped them win the war. Question: What's the photograph next to Carey's photo? Bill Lupetti: It's a group of OSS, Office of Strategic Service guys, who in 1945 had trained the Viet Minh to fight the Japanese. They came back to Vietnam in 1995 and had a reunion. It's a propaganda museum. The Vietnamese communists are saying that these people from around the world supported their resistance movement. The point is that these are the people who helped them win the war and set up their communist government. They are honoring Kerry as being one of the guys who helped them. Kerry is a hero to the Vietnamese communists. He was a hero to them during the war, and he is a hero to them now. To get independent confirmation, we also contacted Dan Tran of the Vietnam Human Rights Project, who asked associates in Ho Chi Minh City to make sure the photograph of John Kerry was actually in the War Remnants Museum. Tran's contacts confirmed that the photograph is still there. Tran also asked his Vietnamese associates to get a more precise wording of the placards under the photo. Below is the exact English wording. Mr. Do Mui, Secretary General of the Vietnam Communist Party, met with Congressmen and Veterans Delegation in Vietnam, July 15th through 18th, 1993. We then researched whether Kerry met with Do Mui any time between July 15th, 1993 and July 18th, 1993. The Associated Press reported on July 17, 1993, that a U.S. delegation headed by U.S. Deputy Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Herschel Gober, was sent by President Clinton to Vietnam to deliver microfilm of some 3 million captured Vietnam War documents that pertain to finding American POWs and MIAs. The article noted that the mission was scheduled to meet with Communist Party General Secretary Do Mui. While the article did not mention Kerry, a White House press release dated July 2, 1993, mentioned Kerry and a high-level delegation that included representatives from 3 major veterans groups. In a speech given on the Senate floor on April 29, 1992, Kerry discussed in detail a meeting that he had with Do Mui in Vietnam to discuss the fate of American prisoners of war and those missing in action. A photograph widely circulated on the Internet shows Kerry formally posed with Do Mui and a statue of Ho Chi Minh in the background. Thus, the existence of photographs showing Senator Kerry meeting with General Secretary Do Mui is not in question. In the course of pursuing the POW and MIA issue, it is reasonable that Senator Kerry would seek to meet with the leaders of Communist Vietnam. The critical issue here is that the Vietnamese communists have chosen to honor Senator Kerry in their War Remnants Museum for his assistance in helping them achieve victory over the United States. As a senator, John Kerry has consistently supported the Vietnamese communists, continuing the pattern he established with his anti-war protesting activities. One of the more notable instances of Kerry using his senatorial office to advance the cause of the Vietnamese communists involves the Vietnam Human Rights Act, H.R. 28.33, in 2001. Just days before the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the bill by a vote of 410-1. The bill died in the Senate because John Kerry placed a hold on it and prevented it from coming to the floor for a debate. In 2003, Representative Ed Royce, Republican of California, reintroduced the Vietnam Human Rights Act, this time as an amendment to a Foreign Relations Appropriation Bill, the Foreign Relations Authorization Act, H.R. 1950. In a press release after the bill passed the House, Representative Royce noted what he believed the legislation would accomplish. Today's vote was a vote of support for all those struggling for human rights and democracy in Vietnam. The stories of persecution and torture at the hands of Vietnam's communist rulers are staggering and appalling. Innocent people in Vietnam are persecuted because of their religion, ethnicity, or pro-democracy beliefs. This bill is a strike for freedom. In an effort to promote religious freedom and democracy in Vietnam, the bill will prohibit non-humanitarian U.S. aid from being provided to Vietnam unless the Vietnamese government begins freeing political prisoners and respecting the rights of ethnic minorities. The bill also provides additional funding for Radio Free Asia, RFA, to overcome jamming efforts by the Vietnamese government. RFA will now be better able to bring objective news, the truth, to the Vietnamese people, said Royce. Once again, John Kerry took active steps to block the bill's passage in the Senate. The Vietnamese communists have actively fought the legislation every time it has been introduced, arguing that the act constitutes undue meddling in their internal affairs on the basis of fabricated charges. The act's supporters, such as Representative Royce, cite repeated instances in which the Vietnamese communists have repressed Christians, whom they believe undermine their authority. As Representative Royce has charged, the stories of persecution and torture at the hands of the Vietnamese communist rulers are staggering and appalling. Controversy continues over John Kerry's role in chairing the Senate Select Committee on POW/MIA Affairs. In 1993, the commission concluded amid great controversy that there was no compelling evidence that any POWs in Vietnam remained alive. As one critic noted, through much manipulation and arm-twisting, Kerry persuaded his now-defunct committee to vote unanimously that no POWs existed in Vietnam. And with the disappearance of this and the proposed human rights legislation, Kerry gave Bill Clinton and the Democratic Party the pretext they needed to begin reopening trade that could help keep the Marxist Vietnamese dictatorship afloat. Those given first place in line for such trade opportunities, of course, were the biggest contributors to Democrats such as Senator Kerry and Bill Clinton. The year after his committee's vote to give Communist Vietnam a clean bill of health, the strangest thing happened. In December 1992, Vietnam signed its first huge commercial deal, worth at least $905 million, to develop a deep-sea commercial port at Vung Tho to accommodate all the trade that was to come. At the time, the chief executive officer of this company was C. Stuart Forbes. Name sound familiar? It should. He is Senator John F. Kerry's cousin. What a coincidence. Less widely noticed, when the Democratic Party decided to give Kerry a leg up towards its presidential nomination by holding its 2004 National Convention in Boston, certain big corporations rushed to pony up money for the Democratic event. One of the first of these rushing to fill Democratic coffers was Spalding and Sly Colliers, the current corporate partnership involving Colliers International, which anteed up $100,000. Looking at John Kerry's record in the U.S. Senate since 1984, it is difficult, if not impossible, to find any position he took regarding Vietnam that the communists would not favor. Clearly, Kerry's protest activities in the 1970s supported North Vietnam and the Viet Cong in their effort to win the war against America. Today, finding Kerry's photograph in the War Remnants Museum in Ho Chi Minh City is proof of the esteem in which the Vietnamese communists continue to hold Kerry. More than 30 years later, the Vietnamese communists still recognize Senator Kerry's contribution to the continuing success of their resistance. Chapter 10, The Last Chapter, Unfit for Command. Senator Kerry, we were there. We know the truth. We have been silent long enough. The stakes are too great, not only for America in general, but most importantly for those who have followed us into service in Iraq and Afghanistan. We call upon you to provide a full, accurate accounting of your conduct in Vietnam. Letter to Senator Kerry, signed by 200 Swiftboat veterans. John Kerry's 1971 testimony to the Fulbright Committee drew immediate criticism from no less an adversary than William F. Buckley, Jr. During a commencement address on June 8, 1971, to the United States Military Academy at West Point, Buckley explained to the cadets why he considered Kerry's rhetoric to be simply the indictment of an ignorant young man who was willing to level baseless charges that military commanders, three different American presidents, and ultimately the people of the United States had lost their way, waging an immoral war in a criminally atrocious manner. Buckley recognized that Kerry was merely the crystallization of an assault upon America which has been fostered over the years by an intellectual class given over to self-doubt and self-hatred, driven by a cultural disgust with the uses to which so many people put their freedom. Buckley was certain that the graduating West Point cadets would squarely agree with him that America was worth their sacrifice, and felt that it was essential to repel Kerry's assault, for he saw it as an assault on America itself. If America is the monster of John Kerry, burn your commissions tomorrow and take others, which will not bind you in the depraved conspiracy you have heard described. If it is otherwise, remember, the freedom John Kerry enjoys and the freedom I enjoy are quite simply the result of your dedication. Do you wonder that I salute you? At the heart of Buckley's argument was that communism itself was a political system loath to permit the type of freedom that allowed John Kerry to speak so critically. Ronald Reagan was so firm in his opposition to communism that he dared to call the Soviet Union an evil empire. Not satisfied to simply contain communism, Reagan sought to destroy it. Communism, as Reagan saw it, directly opposed the spirit of freedom that breathes in the heart of every human being. Listening to John Kerry's anti-war rhetoric, we get a distinctly different feeling. Communism is not seen as evil. Rather, it is seen as just another political system, possibly somewhat to the left of his own position, but nonetheless a legitimate system, even if imposed on the people of Vietnam by military force. After all, as he characterized it, the Vietnam War was a civil war in which we were outsiders without the right to choose sides. Michael Lind, a senior fellow at the New American Foundation, expressed the significance of this point. U.S. public opinion then was a key factor both in the disastrous outcome in Vietnam and the successful outcome of the Cold War. Kerry, as we have seen, urged the United States to surrender and pull out of Vietnam. Basing his charges of atrocities on lies while still a member of the Naval Reserves, Kerry broke a fundamental bond of trust with those who remained in the field of combat in Vietnam. Since the days of the Roman Empire, the concept of military loyalty up and down the chain of command has been indispensable. The commander's loyalty to the troops earns him their loyalty in return. How can a man be commander-in-chief who for over 30 years has slandered his fellow veterans as war criminals? On a practical basis, John Kerry's breach of loyalty is a prescription of disaster for our armed forces. Today, America is engaged in a new war. A war against the militant Islamic terrorists who attacked us on our own soil. Reasonable people may differ about how best to proceed, but we're sure of one thing. John Kerry is the wrong man to put in charge. War Crimes, John Kerry's Essential Charge. In every war, war crimes are committed. The key to Kerry's argument during the Vietnam War was that the American military was engaged in systematic war crimes as a direct result of military policies, with approval extending all the way up the chain of command. In other words, Kerry's argument was that policies such as free fire zones were inherently criminal, or that the policies necessarily resulted in combat actions that were criminal. This central point in John Kerry's argument was simply false. Yes, instances of war crimes committed by American military forces in Vietnam have been discovered, and very possibly more will be discovered. Yet, when uncovered by the American military, war crimes were investigated, and those involved were punished. As political scientist Gunter Lewy concluded in his 1978 book, America in Vietnam, "The American record in Vietnam with regard to the observance of the law of war is not a succession of war crimes and does not support charges of a systematic and willful violation of existing agreements for standards of human decency in time of war, as many critics of the American involvement have alleged." According to Lewy, the charges of systematic war crimes in Vietnam were based on a distorted picture of the actual battlefield, on ignorance of existing rules of engagement, and on a tendency to construe every mistake of judgment as a wanton breach of the law of war. We have seen arguments made by Swiftboat veterans who have said rules of engagement for free fire zones actually placed more demands on responsible commanders in the field and required more fire discipline, not less. A free fire zone allowed a commander to open fire without being fired upon, but it did not mean that a commander could fire on anything or anyone without exception, without reason, or without justification. Contrary to what Kerry seemed to suggest, a free fire zone did not compel any soldier to fire. Kerry's admission that he himself committed war crimes in Vietnam should be taken very seriously, not as statements intended strictly for political effect, but possibly as honest statements of self-accusation. Still, Kerry carefully qualified every confessional statement by noting that the war crimes he allegedly committed were the result of the orders he had to obey. In the final analysis, Kerry was not only accusing himself, he was accusing all of us. Kerry has never dropped the war crimes theme. Even staffers on his current presidential campaign have fallen into his trap, claiming to have experienced war crimes even though such claims are most likely baseless. Consider, for instance, John Hurley, who is responsible for organizing veterans to support Kerry's 2004 campaign. Hurley told Kerry biographer Douglas Brinkley that he too had seen atrocities when with the U.S. Army's 69th Engineers, operating in the Mekong Delta during the Vietnam War. Tom Pardue, who also served in the 69th Engineer Battalion, challenged Douglas Brinkley on Hurley's assertion. Pardue researched the history of the Army's 69th Engineers and interviewed 48 battalion members, and he could find nothing that documented any atrocities or war crimes having been committed or witnessed by the battalion. Pardue wrote to Brinkley, noting that Hurley gave no specific details in his broad accusation that he had seen atrocities. Finally, on May 5, 2004, Pardue sent out a press release noting that Brinkley issued an apology for recording Hurley's statements, and that the publisher, HarperCollins, indicated that the comment would be removed from a revised edition. Pardue was pleased to have gotten a response from Brinkley and the publisher, as Hurley had ignored his repeated telephone calls and emails. Pardue was satisfied with the end result, but was still not appreciative of Hurley's comment on how he handled the correction. Professor Brinkley indicated that Hurley, at John Kerry National Headquarters, faxed instructions to correct the matter. What remains puzzling is that if it was only a simple mistake, why didn't Hurley issue a public correction immediately? Why didn't he talk to us? Now he's claiming that it's Brinkley's error. If so, you would have thought Hurley would have jumped to correct it earlier and not wait months while a group of vets that served alongside him suffered the undeserved corrosions of their reputations. Thousands of readers were erroneously informed that Hurley saw atrocities in the 69th, and Hurley let it drift, while the reputation of men who fought and some who died alongside him were soiled. I know his boss, John Kerry, has been reluctant to discuss retracting claims seeing atrocities. I hope Senator Kerry didn't pressure John Hurley to let a false report that injured the reputations of Vietnam veterans drift in the wind, in the hopes that the days of retraction would never come. During the 2004 presidential campaign and during countless earlier campaigns, Kerry has had numerous opportunities to retract his war crimes claims. Instead, his campaigns continually hunt for any isolated instance anyone can find of a war crime, so Kerry can continue his generalizations about all American troops serving in Vietnam, repeating the same libelous mistake over 35 years of unsubstantiated accusations. Concealment of records and current fraud. A central drumbeat of the Kerry 2004 presidential campaign, as in every Kerry campaign, is that it is relevant and permissible to discuss at infinite length his short Vietnam service, and to demand that his opponents discuss their military service or lack of it. Any effort, however, to examine his service by seeking out the records and truth is discouraged and resisted. Kerry has been using precisely the same tactics since 1972. The reality is that Kerry has consistently refused to disclose his Vietnam records. Instead, he has released only those service records he considers favorable, while concealing, for example, his own journal and home movies from the period, except for allowing friendly writers to draw from these materials and providing occasional video clips for advertising. There is one very simple government form, Standard Form 180, that Kerry could easily execute to permit the Department of Defense to release all his records, such as the many required records for receiving the Purple Heart or Silver Star. By selectively releasing key information and documents, Kerry has tilted the record in his favor. Self-serving journal entries can be presented to establish events and circumstances as Kerry wishes to portray them. A classic Kerry use of his private photographic cache, some of it self-staged, is Kerry's Lifetime commercial shown during the 2004 campaign, costing tens of millions of dollars in television time. In this commercial, Kerry is depicted receiving a medal from Admiral Zumwalt, who later denounced Kerry. Lifetime also includes a staged clip of Kerry in 1969 as an infantryman in Vietnam, in bandoliers, and violating Rule Number 1 of the infantry by pointing his weapon down, stalking an unknown enemy through the forest. Who took this film? When? And why? The viewer, typically unskilled in evaluating authentic military images, is left with the impression of Kerry as a fierce warrior engaged in the defense of his country. Kerry's tactic appears to be designed to provide the media with a prepackaged message of himself as a war hero, a story ready to be spoon-fed to the uncritical or sympathetic voter. Meanwhile, the second prong of the attack takes on Kerry's opponent, whose service record he usually attempts to disparage and belittle. The Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. On May 4, 2004, a new organization, the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, held its first press conference in Washington, D.C. About 200 Swift Boat veterans from Kerry's unit signed a petition calling on Kerry to execute Standard Form 180 and allow the public to have complete access to his military service record. The signers of the letter include the entire chain of command above Lieutenant Junior Grade Kerry in Vietnam: Lieutenant Commander Grant Hibbard, Lieutenant Commander George Elliott, Captain Charles Plumley, Captain Adrian Lonsdale, and Rear Admiral Roy Hoffman. The letter objected to Kerry's activities seeking to criminalize the Vietnam War, including his staged return of his military medals. The signers called Kerry's honesty about his conduct in Vietnam into question and challenged his ability to command their respect as Commander-in-Chief. Kerry chose to ignore the group. He did not execute Standard Form 180, and he made no personal comment. Behind the scenes, operatives for the Kerry campaign engaged in personal attacks against the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth and its founders. Wade Sanders, a Swift Boat veteran who has been with Kerry since the days of the Winter Soldier investigation, a statement by Sanders is included in The New Soldier, engaged in an email campaign trying to dissuade Swift Boat veterans from taking part in the May 4th press conference. Salon.com, a website sympathetic to Kerry, published articles claiming that Tex Lazar, a law partner of John O'Neill, who had passed away in January 2004, had set up the effort, and, with like attention to detail, that Steve Hayes was a Republican operative controlling the Swifties. Hayes was one of the very few Swifties who publicly endorsed Kerry in the Washington Post. Kerry surrogates explored every conceivable tie to the Republican Party in an attempt to discredit the group as a front for the supposed Republican attack machine. Despite protestations by the Swift Boat veterans that no funding or direction had been asked for or received from the Republican National Committee or the Bush-Cheney campaign, the attacks continued. While the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth press conference was in progress at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., representatives of the Kerry campaign circulated among the press asking hostile questions, prompting the reporters to use these as the basis of their own questions. The Kerry representatives then invited the press to come immediately afterward to a different floor of the National Press Club, where the Kerry campaign planned to hold its own press conference in response. Not once in the response to the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth press conference did any representative of the Kerry campaign explain why Kerry had refused to sign Standard Form 180, while the campaign was simultaneously maintaining its attack on President George W. Bush to release his National Guard records. Ann Toy photograph and petition. On May 17, 2004, the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth called on Kerry to stop the unauthorized use of their images in national campaign advertising. For example, a photograph being run in Kerry's television commercials contains 20 officers, including Kerry. 11 of these men signed the letter condemning Kerry, yet their images were being widely used in Kerry's presidential campaign. The photo was taken on the island of An Toy on January 22, 1969. These 11 officers, together with Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, called upon Kerry to cease the unauthorized use of the photograph. Of the remaining 8 officers in the photograph, 2 are deceased, 4 did not wish to be involved in any manner, and 1 does not support Kerry but did not have the opportunity to sign the letter above. Only 1 of the 19 is believed to support Kerry. William Schumadine, a member of the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth pictured in the photograph, stated, "John Kerry's use of a photograph with his 19 comrades, with knowledge that 11 of them condemn him and 6 who cannot or do not want to be involved, is a complete misrepresentation to the public and a total fraud." Swift Boat Veterans for Truth displayed 3 photographs on its website, www.swiftboats.com. The first is the original photograph from An Toy on January 22, 1969. The second photograph displays each sailor's name over his silhouette and a description of each man's position on the issue. The third photograph shows the one sailor who has agreed to support John Kerry in the 2004 presidential campaign. Again, the response by the Kerry campaign was to ignore the request to stop using the photograph. Spokespeople for the Kerry campaign contended 2 points: that the photograph was in the public domain, so Kerry could use it without permission, and second, that the photograph on www.wintersoldier.com had been altered. What the Kerry campaign had refused to do was to be honest. Rather than pull the photograph as requested, the Kerry campaign chose to allow the public to have the misleading impression that Kerry was surrounded by Navy buddies who admired him then and now. Conclusion. Unfit for command. Many historians have surveyed and rated the record of American presidents as commanders-in-chief. Filling the shoes of Abraham Lincoln or Franklin Roosevelt when the nation is confronted with a shadowy war on terror is hardly a simple task. It is clear that at the very heart of Lincoln and Roosevelt's success was trust, the simple trust of those dealing with them in their integrity and their genuine concern for those, from the highest to the lowest ranks, serving under them. The questions about John Kerry extend across several dimensions, but they always end with the problem that, for many veterans, Kerry broke the fundamentals of trust that must be in place to command others successfully. John Kerry has strangely sought to invoke a heroic Shakespearean image drawn from Henry V, a small band of brothers outnumbered by a large French army at Agincourt. Imagine how that English army would have felt about a brother who had met privately with the French, as Kerry did with the North Vietnamese, while the battle was still joined. Or about a brother who left in an abbreviated and controversial way after barely one-third of a normal tour of duty, only to return home and claim that his brothers, who still remained in combat, were war criminals. As the bard wrote in Act 4, Scene 3, "He which hath no stomach to this fight, let him depart. We would not die in that man's company." Why then do we oppose John Kerry in such a public way? It is not so much resentment at his false charges or his exaggerated and fictionalized self-promotion, although this is certainly present. What motivates us is a genuine fear for the consequences to our nation if its safety is placed in the hands of so cynical and shifting a commander-in-chief. We were not war criminals, either fighting in Vietnam or remaining here as citizens of the United States during time of war. No man who ever died as an American prisoner of war in a North Vietnamese prison was ever forced to hear our testimony in support of the enemy. Yet forgiving and forgetting are not the questions here. The question is one of fitness and character. The loyalty that is indispensable to successful command cannot simply be restored because a person now wants to be a leader. John Kerry might well continue in the Senate, but as commander-in-chief he has, unfortunately, breached the trust it would take to hold his band of brothers together. In the end, our objection to John Kerry is not his past. It is the future, as predicted by his past. This concludes the reading of Unfit for Command by John E. O'Neill and Jerome R. Corsi, Ph.D. Copyright 2004 by John E. O'Neill and Jerome L. Corsi. This book was read by Jeff Riggenbach. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Regnery Publishing and was produced in 2004 by Blackstone Audio Books, Incorporated, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.